voice of Bonnie Kolak. My voice is the voice of Rick Kogan. I am here with my great friend. We've been colleagues. We're still kind of colleagues. We were colleagues for many, many years at the Tribune. His name is Mark Caro. His third book is, and I'm calling this your book. I want to get to the bottom of this whole book. It's called Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope by Anthony Griffith and Bridget Travis Griffin.
Brigetta,
whatever. She's not here. She's not listening. Brigetta Travis Griffin with Mark Caro. What does this mean? It's on the cover. And the bookmark, I got to tell you, and I want to get to the bottom of your contribution to this, which may have been considerable. The book's fascinating. This guy is a fascinating guy.
Well, that was why I did it. I mean, it's a great story. It's a great Chicago story, but it's a great human story about a guy who just went through so much, and we could get into what it's about.
Yeah,
but
sure.
This is the sort of situation people are like, are you a ghostwriter? And I'm like, well, I'm not a ghostwriter because my name's on the cover, so that's good. It is their story, it is told in their voices, and sometimes as a writer, I mean, actually always as a writer, you're there to serve whatever story you're trying to tell.
No question.
And this was a story that I was hired to do. I was hired to tell the story.
By whom?
I was hired to do it originally by the people at William Morris Endeavor.
Oh, okay.
Do you want to know what the back? Do you want the backstory?
I do.
I'll tell you the backstory
if you can.
Okay, so. All right. Well, I'll tell you my backstory on it.
A different story, but we'll get to that later.
Brigetta's story is in the book, but yeah, no, she has a great story. But my involvement in it was that I had spoken to the agents at William Morris Endeavor after I left the Tribune, after being there for like 26 years. And I was just looking for bigger projects to do. And I talked with them about, I had some nonfiction books that I was pitching, and they said, would you ever be up for collaborating on something where you'd be the writer to tell someone's story? And I said, if it's interesting enough, sure. And at some point, I remember this very well. I was with my friend James Finn Garner, the author of Correct Bedtime Stories, and a great guy. If you're a
frequent guest on this show.
We were together in Michigan, and we were going to do like a writer's retreat weekend, and I got a email from this person who runs the New York office of William Morris Endeavor saying, watch this, and it was a YouTube link, and it was a link to Anthony Griffith telling a monologue on The Moth. So you know The Moth Radio Hour, and it's these monologues, and he tells this monologue about the year of 1990 being sort of the best of times, worst of times, and how he had grown up in Chicago. He'd grown up on the South Side. And in 1990, he and his wife, Brigetta, and their two-year-old daughter, Brittany, moved out to Los Angeles. And he was booked to be on The Tonight Show. He was a finalist on Star Search, and he was booked to be on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, like in the sort of last period of Johnny. And if you're a comedian and you grew up on, you're
that's
in the projects
it.
In the West Side, you're in the South Side, and it's like the idea of being on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson is it. I mean, that is the dream. But at the same time, his two-year-old daughter was diagnosed with leukemia, and she'd actually gone through a bout of it in Chicago before they moved. They were in remission, but then it came back, and he was going through trying to be funny on the show three times with Johnny Carson. He was on within less than a year while his daughter was just going downhill. So as a writer at first, I thought this is a bit much. It's a really powerful, if anyone's listening, just Google Anthony Griffith, and The Moth.
And then buy this book, The Laughter.
And buy the book.
Yes.
The book is even better than The Moth. But it's a very powerful monologue. And at first I thought, oh, someone with a dying kid is like, that would be hard to go after as a writer, as a parent, and it just seems so loaded. But this was the week, it was the Friday after the inauguration. It was exactly a week after the inauguration. And not to get all political here, but I thought the theme of this book is really, how do you do your job? How do you continue to move forward when you think the world is falling apart?
There's a line. It's a line on page 99. How do you write, the three of you write, And my Tonight Show appearance was coming up. How do you do your job when your world is falling apart?
That, very good. That's the theme of the book right there on page 99. And they sort of, they kind of did a version of that on the back of the book, too. They said, how do you keep going when your world is falling apart?
No, I like this one.
Do your job
more.
Is better. No, because that's what it is. I mean, because everyone has to, we all deal with things. I mean, you've dealt with things.
Sure.
I've dealt with things where tough stuff is going on in your family or politically, you're sort of worried about people, and it's just like, but you still got to focus and do your job. And his job was to make people laugh when he felt as unfunny as anyone could feel.
Well, that's how the book begins. It begins on the most exciting day of my career in the worst year of my life. I want to continue. I want to tell you all the other things Mark Caro's doing too, but I want to get a little bit more about how the actual work for this book. I mean, it's interviews. It's at some points they are obviously talking to you simultaneously. You've done a masterful.
It would appear that way.
Well, that's your genius, Mark Caro. We'll be back. So, Mark Caro, you get this call. Think, well, okay, this story could be interesting, and this story could be one that. Because we all are going to have to do our jobs as the world is falling apart after a certain election. Do you meet these people before? Do you meet Anthony Griffin and Brigitta Travis Griffin?
Brigitta. I know. I don't remember if I left in the phoneticization. I can't even phoneticize.
Brigitta.
I know. So originally it was Anthony's story. And the reason... William Morris is calling me. You know, normally you don't have a talent agency calling you to write a book, right?
Right, sure.
Now they do books like this. So actually,
they package
that, and they have so different people who want to write memoirs but aren't writers, they will hire a writer to work with this person. I mean, Derek Rose has a book that just came out,
sure,
right?
We know Sam Derek. Smith, we know Derek Rose didn't write that book.
Yeah, no, and Sam Smith, who's writes for Bulls.com and formerly at the Tribune, you know, he's credited on there. I think Bob Verdi did the Jim McMahon book way back when. Their interest in it was that they're trying to make a movie of his life. And so... Actually, the backstory there was that Ari Emanuel. So we're going back to Chicago roots again.
Yes,
Ari Emanuel, the mayor, the brother of our ex-mayor, and one of the most powerful men in Hollywood. Most powerful people in Hollywood. Yeah. He runs William Morris Endeavor, which is, you know, Endeavor, which was his agency. Anyway, he runs that. His son, who is now in college, was shown The Moth. In his English class in L.A. and came back and was basically like, Dad, you got to check this out. And they decided they're going to make a movie about this guy's life. So they needed a book to base the movie on. So that was how that was why they called me, because I was from Chicago and they talked to me.
You know, and, movies.
And I don't think they were thinking about the movie thing. But part of what was interesting for me also was... Hey, you know, I covered the movie business a lot, obviously, obviously to you, at least not to all the listeners.
Yeah, he did.
Listeners, I wrote a lot about movies, and I'm a movie nut, and so I thought the idea of writing something that would become the basis for a movie was also really interesting. And in fact, when I was working on the proposal for the book, I was kind of structuring it. I was very conscious of it being scenes. Like, I'm like, this is the, you know, best actress scene for Brigitta here, and this is, you know, this is the arc of the thing, and So that was the driving force, was getting the book, and then they want to make the movie. And they're still trying to make the movie. I mean,
I don't doubt that for a second.
It's in pre-production or development or whatever you would call it. I guess you'd say development.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, too, I mean, so you sit down, you obviously, dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of hours of conversations with these two. And then
especially Anthony.
You start to structure it. I love that. I mean, there's a wonderful thing here. There's a lot of Chicago in here, ladies and gentlemen, and a lot of, black clubs and the whole comedy scene.
That was the other thing. The whole entertainment industry part of it and the comedy world was fascinating to me.
Well, here's what he writes. Again, it's hooked a lot, and I can see a movie starting with this guy standing backstage awaiting Johnny's call. I really can't. You write here, as we step through the gray curtain from which Johnny and his guests emerged every night, I flash back to when I was a kid and got to be in the audience of the Chicago-based Bozo Circus. Like most kids in Chicago, I used to watch Bozo on television, and those characters and games seemed to exist in a world of their own. Yet when I was in the stands, I'm jumping around here and not writing the true prose of Mark Caro. I was amazed at how tiny the Bozo set was. It was almost like a living room. A magician would perform against one wall, then the cameras would pan to a game being played beside another wall, then we'd watch Bozo and Cookie throwing pies or something a few feet away. The performers were smaller than I expected, too. That was my introduction to the magic of television. Now, as I took in the late-night talk show set, I realized the Tonight Show was Bozo. That is just a great bit. And I know you wrote, nobody talks like that.
No, but he did. Well, no. Okay,
I mean, I'm sure he gave you that.
So this is the nuts and bolts of how it worked. So I would talk to Anthony twice a week for an hour to an hour and a half over many, many months. And I wrote down, when I went out to LA, I recorded him. When I was on the phone with him, I typed really fast. And everything that is in the book is stuff that he said.
Sure, of course.
It's just that if you transcribed stuff that people say, it's not a book. It sounds much more rambling. And people think that the illusion of any book like this is that it sounds like they're talking to you, but and this is the illusion of, you know, journalism when we're writing too, where people say, hey, I like the story because it sounded like you, and I'm like, yeah, it sounds like me because you work really hard to make
That's
it sound right. effortless.
I get the sense from the book. I mean, not only that you admire him, I get the sense that you liked him.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
he's a great guy.
Well, he also, we can tell this, one of the interesting things, I think it's in here somewhere, that when their little daughter sadly died, she's going through chemo and then she dies, and they didn't share, they were reluctant to share this with anybody until that famous moth thing you're talking about. Why was that? I thought there's a line in here maybe where she says, if there had been Facebook, maybe we would have shared this.
I remember I was out in LA and we were having breakfast and I was sort of asking about this. I was saying, you know, if this had happened now, it's hard to imagine that someone would go through what he went through now and people not knowing about it. And he didn't tell his manager.
I know.
I mean, he didn't tell anyone that he had this daughter who was sick and what was going on. And he just kept it all inside. And that was sort of the way he acted. And you know, the other thing that he kept inside is that, a couple of years after his daughter dies, he's diagnosed with MS.
Oh, man,
he didn't tell anyone that. And so when he's slowing down, people think, oh, is he drunk today or something? And it was just because he was slowing down. And now, you know, he's upfront about it. He still performs and everything else. So I was saying, you know, over this breakfast, would you have, would people know about it? Would you have put this on Facebook? And she's just like, I don't know. We might have. It's like at the time, you know, our family was Facebook. You know, we would just, you know, tell my mother, my grandmother, and then.
Yeah, that's a very interesting thing in here. His wife, and the book alternates between long sections from Anthony and not so long sections from Brigitta. She writes, the first thing I noticed were the changes in Anthony's voice and dexterity. He also struggled to come up with words. He described the function of an object instead of the object itself. Over time, his vocabulary choices became so different from what they had been. As the years went by, I started to fill in the blanks for him, to feed him the right words, until one of the doctors told me, you got to stop doing that. You've got to let him do the cerebral work. It's not chilling to me, but it's a very moving couple paragraphs, Mark.
And she, so she went on to be, it's not a spoiler to know that their daughter dies.
Right.
And what's remarkable about them is that they're a couple that's together over 30 years later. They went through this horrible thing together, and then he's diagnosed with MS, which is this degenerative disease, and they never were able to have another child, and yet they're still together. And she went back to school and became a child therapist, a child psychologist, and so she's around kids who could remind her of her daughter all the time, as opposed to not, you know, and being and trying to help those kids as opposed to just trying to avoid kids altogether. And he teaches Sunday school as well. So they've kind of leaned into that part of their life after sort of having their sort of 10 years of, you know, what they call the zombie years, where they're just sort of grieving and not really dealing with this stuff. So she's, so that, those pair of those passages from her, I mean, that really is her. That's, and part of what's fun about the book is that they really do have distinct voices, and you could tell he sounds like him and she sounds like her, and they're very different people, but they're also complementary in really interesting ways.
Now, I want to talk about many of your other projects too and get back to this, but the, was she part of the deal at the very beginning, or did she?
No. So it was originally they bought Anthony's life rights had been bought for this movie, and I was writing the book for Anthony. And but in working on the proposal, I included, because the story, it's a story is of them. You know, there's, it's about them as a couple, and there's some things that it, there, it's like you sort of just needed her perspective in it, and so I made her pretty prominent in the proposal. The material.
You would have to be, and
one of the ways to deal with it was to sort of have these kind of alternating voices in it, and I think that there was a little bit of that in the sample. I think the sample chapter was really all Anthony, but there was some stuff I had in there was her voice as well as part of this long proposal, because you got to write up this long proposal to send out to publishers.
Yeah, to get a deal. Yeah.
And the publisher that bought it, they said, we think that Brigetta should be a co-author of the book.
Gotcha.
You know, if one of the other publishers had bought it, it might have just been Anthony.
Yeah.
But as the writer, I will say that it would have been really hard to tell the story fully without her input.
Agreed.
And all that she says.
Agreed. Again, the title of the book is Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope by Mark Caro, Anthony Griffith, Brigetta Travis Griffin. You should get it. It's a it's not a long book, but it's densely packed, man. And it if you know anything of the Chicago comedy scene when this guy started out, you'll get a kick.
You get Bernie Mac anecdotes.
I know. Yeah, we got to have Bernie Mac's in the book too. So we'll talk more about that. We'll talk about more of Mark's career. I know he has a novel that he's been working on for a long time.
Oh man,
do we? Can we talk about it?
Sure.
Okay, good. Welcome back. Talking to Mark Caro. We've spent a lot of time talking about Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope by Anthony Griffith, by Brigetta Travis
Brigetta.
Griffin. Brigetta. I'm never going to get her name
hold
right.
It up.
Yeah, I'm never going to get her name. But written by Anthony Griffith and Mark Caro. Just do that. Google that. It's a great book. What else are you working on? I know. I mean, we used to talk when you worked at the Tribune when we were colleagues about a novel.
Did we talk about that? I'm like, yeah. Embarrassed. It's like sort of like talking about like your screenplay that never got produced. I do. I did finish it actually after I left, and it's sitting right now with a big time agent in New York who I keep waiting to get back to me.
That's great.
Sort of just, well, I don't know.
Well, no, it no, might no. Be, I mean, but it's, no. The fact
it's
no,
driving me crazy.
No, finishing it is the big deal.
Yeah, I finished a draft of it. And then actually I had so I finished a draft of it, got a lot of notes, and then I had to finish the draft of this, Behind the Laughter. And then I actually had another project that was ghostwriting, so I won't even tell you what it is.
Okay.
But there's a book that's coming out later this year that I did a quote-unquote polish on, that probably a lot of people will read, and they will have no idea that I had anything to do with it unless they know members of my writers group, because some of their last names suddenly showed up in it.
See, I know some of those. I know. So maybe I'll figure it out.
And then, so I did those, and then I went back, and I cut, like, a quarter of the book out, which is what you have to do, or maybe like 20%.
Yeah, yeah.
Stephen King said second draft equals first draft minus 10%, which I thought actually
well,
was really good.
Stephen King,
and I did.
Yeah.
And at first, it was hard for me to get to that 10%, but after I went and reworked this troublesome manuscript I was hired to fix, my knives were really sharp, and I went back at my novel in that spirit, and so it got down to like it's a normal length. It's like 100,000 words, and
I'm
just sort of waiting.
Crossed. I want to read it.
I'll send it to you.
You also do a great deal of freelancing now for Chicago Magazine, which is a monthly magazine, so
yeah.
You can't do a great deal. You're right. Doing
long pieces, though. Those are fun.
Those are fun. The last one was about, what was that wonderful actress?
Carrie Coon?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Carrie Coon and John Lovey, who's a civil rights attorney, they were like back-to-back months, and now I have one in the August issue, so it's actually in the late editing stages right now, profile of a certain prominent person in the restaurant world. His last name rhymes with Rick Ronis. So,
how do you like? I mean, one of the reasons the Tribune no longer had a magazine when you left. I mean,
I know, and I liked writing for the Tribune magazine.
Yeah,
when I did
it was
that.
Fun. It's a different kind of. It's a different form. You also did that. You every year do this fantastic Oscar quiz that I'm no good at because I don't see movies anymore. But you love doing that, don't you?
I do because it's sadistic. I just because it's multiple choice, and it's like, you know, if you play that game, I guess the commercial name is Balderdash. You know, we have other names for it. You know, where you're sort of making up fake answers. It's just I like making up fake movie answers. But the other thing is that I mean I literally did 25 of them for the Tribune. And I know I'm old. I started very young, people.
He did.
The first year I was at the Tribune as a freelancer, I wrote an Oscar quiz, and then I kept doing it. And but for me, it was that I would sort of take whatever was going on with this year's Oscars and find really weird, interesting facts, and then write questions around them. So I wrote it for the New York Times a few years. Actually.
Yeah,
they ran it like the last three years, and then it was back in the Trib this year. But it was in the New York Times, and they would complain to me like, "Well, this is too hard." And I'm like, "You're the New York Times.
Yeah, try your Sunday crossword
puzzle. If it's easy,
puzzle,
that means
idiots.
you're not learning anything. You know, if you know all the answers, then what's the point of taking an Oscar quiz? If you just know, if I say, oh, you know." Jennifer Hudson won this Oscar for what movie? A, Popeye. B, Dreamgirls. C, The Godfather.
Taxi Driver.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I got that one right. I feel good. New York Times.
The other
come
thing
on.
You were doing that I thought was a fascinating idea. It was a film series called "Is It Still Funny?"
Oh yeah.
Are you doing?
I know. I want to keep doing that.
Talk about I just thought that was such a good idea. You're tapping into
the fact that I have a lot of ideas that I execute with
You bring them to fruition, too.
I do, some of them, but then they kind of disappear for a while, and then I start doing other things. Like, I just started this new series at Space called Mark Caro's Talking in Space.
That's right.
My first guest was Chris Jones, and I have, I think, a second guest lined up who's pretty good.
Who is it?
But, well, she has to confirm.
Say.
Well, I
That's
would
okay.
if she would have confirmed when I sent my last email, but I think that it's going to happen. Bonnie Hunt is going to do one at some point.
Oh, that's
trying
great.
To get that going.
And it's basically a one-on-one conversation stage at that incredible club in
Evanston. It's just a great place. And it's sort of fun. But yeah, Is It Still Funny was, and hopefully still is, because I've actually been readdressing this recently. But, you know, when you see a movie and you just think it's the funniest movie you've ever seen, and then you go back and you catch it on cable and you're sitting on your couch and no one's around you and you're like, this doesn't seem quite as funny as I thought it was. Or you're afraid to watch it on cable or Blu-ray or whatever because you think it's not going to hold up. Whereas if you could see it in a theater with a couple hundred people again, then you could recreate that. And seeing a comedy in the theater is just, if I see The Godfather on someone's really good or my own not so great, but still, you know, high def screen.
Sure.
It's The Godfather. But if I see, you know, I don't know, Animal House, it's different in a theater than it is at home. It just is. And in fact, Animal House was the first one we did. And so I did a bunch of them at the Music Box. I think we did 20 of them over a couple of years.
Yeah.
But then it's hard. And I've talked to like the Film Center about this too. It's very hard for these theaters to sort of plug in these one-offs because there are all these commercial runs that they have and all these obligations that they have. And so the Music Box was great. I loved working with them. I mean, I came on to, you know, this station to talk about it a few times.
Sure.
And it was fantastic. And I mean, I got to see Harold and Maude on a big screen, and I wrote about that for the New York Times. I got to double dip on that. And it was funny again. And Animal House was really interesting because when Animal House came out, everyone laughed when John Belushi, I haven't lost it that much.
Brigetta. Okay.
John Belushi smashes Stephen Bishop's, I got his name right, guitar against the wall. But when we did it at Is It Still Funny, the laugh came the moment John Belushi pauses on the stairs. Before he even grabs that guitar, everyone is dying of laughter because they see in his look he's about to take that guitar and smash it because it's different.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I love doing it. I would love to do it back at the Music Box. Their scheduling became a little bit difficult and just stuff was getting bumped around. And I mean, this is like inside baseball, but they have one theater that's 700 seats and one that's 70 seats. And if you're drawing 200 people to a screening, it's, you know, going into the smaller theater isn't great, even though I did some of the smaller theater and it's really nice room. It's a great place to do it.
That too.
Yeah, and it's just it's a sort of a good place to do it.
But you can't make money doing it. That's the other.
Well, I wasn't, you know,
I know.
It's just a labor. It's just a fun thing to do.
Well, that's one of the great things. You get to, you know, exercise your passions. I think you do.
I'm trying to do that and have it make sense as a job.
Yeah.
And some weeks it makes more sense than others, but I'm glad to have, I really wanted to finish some more books, and the books I thought I was going to write, I haven't written except for the novel, which I did, but that's, you know,
maybe
if that comes out.
Maybe they're coming.
No, the novel, I'm going to be in here. We're going to talk about the novel and the film adaptation.
That'd be great.
And the Oscar that Jessica Chastain wins for.
Well,
you did
a modest amount of radio work with our friend and colleague, Chris Jones. You guys were great.
Hint, hint. Yeah.
Todd, if you're listening.
Yeah, no, I love doing it. And Chris did, too. We had fun together as well. So,
and he's got that accent going for him, too.
So. Well, this is good because you could tell us apart. I mean, obviously, that can be. We could tell you and I apart
also. Yeah, that's right.
So.
That's right. Mark, do you miss the paper at all?
Absolutely. I do. I know. Well, I miss my idea of it. No, you know what? I miss the most obvious things I miss about it. I miss the people. I miss going in to see all the people I worked with. I think it's a self-selective group of really interesting people. They're smart. They're funny. I would, you know, if I'm stuck writing something, I could just shout over to someone and say, "Hey, Chris," whether it's Borelli or Jones or whatever, or go over to you or talk to numerous people and have great conversations. And I miss that. And I also just miss, you know, having an idea and being able to execute it and get it in print and have people read it so quickly. I do that on Facebook now, you know, or you do it on Twitter,
it's not the same.
So, you know,
you have some very provocative questions on Facebook and Twitter, you know, about songs and about bands. The book, again, it's great to see you, by the way.
You too.
Behind the Laughter, A Comedian's Tale of Tragedy and Hope by Anthony Griffith, by Brigetta, I get it?
Brigetta, yes.
Brigetta, okay, finally, 18 times I got
you
it.
Got
Brigetta,
it right
Travis Griffin, and Mark Caro. It's really, I found it to be an exciting and touching and very compelling book, and that is, I know how these things go, and that's to the credit of my guest, Mark Caro, and my friend.
Well, it's all a matter of drawing the story out of the people. It's their story, it's their humor, and their heart, and they're wonderful subjects.
Yeah.
And I was happy and honored to be able to work with them.
Well, it's one of many. I'll have a whole Mark Caro bookshelf. Talk about the other book. Talk about you know, let's keep him for, stay for five more minutes. Talk about Foie Gras Wars, which was your first book, which was based
10-year
on...
10-year anniversary was...
Is that right? It's that
I know,
long?
Isn't that bad?
Wow!
I feel so...
Wow!
I don't feel so old until I realize I am, so...
That was
like,
about the crazy city council banning foie gras at Chicago...
Yeah, but that happened because Joe Moore read a front page story I wrote about foie gras.
That's right.
And he's like, I said, what... What asked you to? What provoked you to propose banning foie gras in the city of Chicago? He was for Rogers Park and everything until very recently, and and he's like, well, I read this story on the front page of the Tribune, and I'm like, I wrote that story. There was nothing in there that said ban foie gras. Charlie Trotter didn't. I mean, so the backstory on that was just real quickly that Charlie Trotter had foie gras is the fattened liver of a. Goose or duck, really a duck in the U.S. And it's a delicacy. And Charlie Trotter's, back when that restaurant was at its heyday, served a lot of it. And then Charlie Trotter quit serving it altogether because he said it was cruel. He said sort of after the fact, 3 years after the fact, he had quit serving it. I wrote a story about it. I talked to other chefs about whether they thought it was okay to serve or not. And I talked to Rick Tramonto, who was the chef at True, which at that time was sort of the other, you know, like kind of battling Trotter for supremacy in Chicago. He said, you know, it's a little hypocritical. Either you're raising animals that you kill them and eat them, or you're not. And I, when I called Trotter back and told him what Rick had said, he's like, well, you know, Rick Tremonto's not the smartest guy on the block.
Right, right.
You know, yeah, basically called him an idiot and said his liver, we should eat his liver for a little treat. It's fat enough. So that got that story on the front page.
Oh, yeah.
Alderman read it. Boom. Foie gras ban. So, but that was a fun
book. But it was. That was a good book. 10 years. Wow. Time is flying, man. Time is flying.
I had the best. You know what I'm proudest of now? I mean, like, the work and the book are really, you know, they're fine.
Yeah.
You should read it. You could find it pretty heavily discounted on Amazon right now, but you still should. But I have the most eclectic group of blurbers on the back. Like, I will name drop my blurbers because I'm very proud of my blurbers. Well, Michael Ruhlman, who is a prominent food writer. Anthony Bourdain.
Wow. The late Anthony Bourdain.
Roger Ebert.
The late Roger Ebert.
And Temple Grandin.
Oh, my God, the famous horse autistic.
Claire Danes. She won an Emmy for playing it. But before Claire Danes, there was the Foie Gras Wars and her giving me a blurb because she was all about animal welfare.
Yeah, that was a great book. Mark, it's great to see you.
Oh, great to see you, too.
Love to the family, and you'll be back on. Let's get that novel out.
Yeah, that would be good.
All right.
All right.
Good. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. The great Bonnie Kolak is playing next Saturday. Next Saturday at 4 p.m. at the Acorn Theater in beautiful Three Oaks, Michigan. Go to see Bonnie. You can go to hear Bonnie. She never plays enough for my taste. And then after the show, you can go to Nelson's, which I call the Billy Goat of Three Oaks, and have some drinks and some cheeseburgers. Bonnie is among the greatest singers to ever call Chicago home. Here she is from her CD called Here to Sing, Singing Skylark.
Is there a meadow in the mist where someone's waiting to be kissed? Skylark, have you seen a valley green with spring where my heart can go a journey over the shadows and the rain to a blossom covered lay, and in your lonely flight, haven't you heard the music in the night? Wonderful music, faint as a will-o'-the-wisp, crazy as a loon, sad as a gypsy serenade. Riding on your wings. So if you see them anywhere, won't you lead me there? see them anywhere? Won't you lead me there?
Bonnie Kolak, you can hear that voice next Saturday at 4 o'clock. Just go to acorntheater.com. That's all you need. It's in Three Oaks, Michigan, and it might be Sunday. I don't know. It's a Saturday or Sunday at Three Oaks at 4 o'clock. And then go to Nelson's afterward, and you might hear this song. This is a bit of the I Love You Waltz.
Surprise, introduced to me by a good friend. And little did I know how the song would go when you asked me to dance and I said yes. Well, I hadn't danced in years, I was clumsy. But you slowly took me by the hand. Now we're partners in life, and I dance as your wife, and you slowly move me round the floor. For we dance to the I Love You slowly move around the floor.
Welcome back. At 10:30, I will have three people in here to articulate the and explain the controversy going on at Montrose Beach. But a few weeks ago, I was at my friends Lauren Stryker and Jason Brett's house, and they had a friend in who read from her novel. And as usual, you want to support people and you buy the novel. And then I started reading the novel and I thought, wow, this is really a good novel. And that is the reason Lorraine Devon Wilkie, the author of that novel, is on the telephone. Lorraine, it really is a good book.
Oh, thank you, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. Before we get into the details of it, I need the listeners to know your background. You're Chicago born and bred and the third of 11 children. Where were you brought up?
That's true.
Where were you brought up?
I was brought up, actually, lived the beginning years of my life in the city. My parents were both born and raised in the city. And then we moved to a tiny little farm town in northern Illinois called Richmond.
Oh, I knew Richmond.
Which is about as far
right near
north
the border.
In Illinois
right
as you
near
can
the border.
Get.
Border,
I mean, we could ride our bikes to Wisconsin. And I did my high school years in Crystal Lake, mm-hmm. and then I went to the University of Illinois. And in between all of that, I was working in Chicago. My grandmother was in Chicago and spent a lot of time there. And I had a band that we played in Chicago all over the place. So Chicago has been a real touchstone location for me throughout my whole life. And I have a lot of family and friends still living there. So it's a pretty special city to me.
Well, it's a special... you evoke it in this book. I know you live in L.A. and have been out in L.A. for some time, but you still have
right.
a real sense of the city in the alchemy of noise. You know, the interesting thing is I read this book, and liked it so much that I ordered your previous novels after The Sucker Punch and Hysterical Love, and I'm doing a reading balancing act with those two books. But I need to know, Lorraine, when did you start writing? It's nice to go out to L.A. and be in a band and get married and, you know, have a
do
kid.
All that stuff. Well,
yeah.
You know, I think I was writing, starting in about, seriously writing, well, actually in high school. I had an English teacher.
Who inspired you?
Mrs. Amahorn, who I loved and who mentored me. I was the editor of the literary magazine. And so I started writing then, but I didn't really get into it deeply. I did it in college as well, but it was really in about the 80s when I started writing screenplays, along with being in a band and being very plugged into the 80s music scene in LA, which was insane.
Yeah.
But I was also writing screenplays. And throughout that time, I wrote several. One got produced in Seattle, a little independent film in the early 90s. And during all of that time, I was also writing articles. And starting in about early, 2010, I started a blog. And then I started writing for the Huffington Post. I'd sent Arianna Huffington, who was with them at the time. I sent her my blog, and she invited me to write with them, which I did for them the next 7 years until they shut down that program last year. And it was during that time that I always fantasized about writing a novel, but never felt like I had a topic that merited the medium until I got the idea for the story of After the Sucker Punch, which is the first novel I wrote. Mm-hmm. I think that came out in 2014. And so that's just, I think because I'm a reader and I love words, my father was a writer and raised us on books, and so it's always been a medium that's resonated with me. So it's not as much of a... it's not as divergent from my path as a performer and a singer and a songwriter and actress as it might seem, because it's all about storytelling, right? It's all about that.
I agree. But this one, I have not, as I said, I have your two previous novels. This one seems it's not only terribly provocative and moves like a freight train, frankly, but it's a very, very, very ambitious book. Do you not agree? I'm sure you think, it's just what I have to say. It's pretty ambitious,
Lorraine.
No, I mean,
I think it's where it might be ambitious and where people have asked me about why I chose to do this was that I decided to tell the story from the points of view of both the characters,
and
a black man and a white woman.
Yes.
And that,
it's an interracial relationship. And you almost, yeah. I mean, you say in the book, and you also say that given the subject matter of this book, I wanted to share a little background as to why I felt this specific story was mine to tell. Why did you feel the need to do that, to explain?
Because the year prior to getting this book published, which I finally did with an incredible small publishing company out of Berkeley, California called She Writes Press, prior to that, I was trying to get a literary agent to go the traditional route and go to the traditional publishing companies. And for a solid year, I shopped for an agent. And every single one of them told me that responded to me, and most of them didn't. But the ones that did, and several of them actually read the book, said...
Well, that's a miracle in itself, yeah.
I know,
yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
They said they did. We don't know, actually. but they said, I won't touch it, because white writers writing black characters is considered... to use your word, provocative. It is not something the publishing industry is comfortable with because there's a lot of pushback on this. There's a lot of pushback on what's considered cultural appropriation and the fact that there is a tremendous lack of diversity in the publishing industry. And so a white author including black characters and a black story in her book, that is probably the most ambitious part of this. So when you say, why did I feel I need to explain
it? I get it now.
Because I understand that. I understand that debate. I do. I understand it. I understand because as a woman, I know what it's like to be left on the outside of opportunities that are made so simple for men. And so I didn't, I wanted it to be clear that it wasn't like I just went, hey, I think I'm going to write a story about slavery or something that was completely unrelated to my life. I had actually had an experience.
Exactly, for a relatively lengthy time.
Yeah, it was a 6-year relationship with a man of color, and it was through that experience that I witnessed and tangentially experienced the core of this story. The story is very fictional. It's not our story. It's not him. It's not me.
Yeah.
But through that experience, I had the cold water dip of having proximity to the black experience in America, and I guess other than, I don't know how you get any closer than actually living in the black experience with a black person or in a black community or whatever.
But it also gave you, Lorraine, a perspective on white privilege as well, did it not? I mean, that's one of these sort of threads of your fine novel, The Alchemy of Noise. And I, you know, most white people don't even understand the nature of white privilege because they don't live in a world where they are not privileged.
That's absolutely true. And it's interesting because, you know, some people said, is this still timely? And, of course, everybody that's read the book and many of them have left reviews have commented on how shocking the book has been because and most of these are white readers, when you are not involved in what happens to people of color that we see on the news, on social media, everywhere, it's out there somewhere, right? It's out there. It's not happening to you. And so you have a very different experience of it than you do when you have proximity to it. So white privilege allows us that distance and allows us that detachment from that. And unfortunately, that detachment is part of why the problem exists, because the detachment can contribute to actual prejudice and bigotry.
Absolutely,
but
and the lack of understanding, and it contributes
to
fearfulness. Yeah,
exactly. Lack of empathy, lack of understanding.
Sure.
You know, comments like, they just need to get over it, or they need to get on with it. And that just reveals such a tremendous disconnect from what's really going on out there.
I'm going to read, I just want to read something to give people a sense. We'll talk a little more about this after a commercial break, but chapter 65, it's immaterial to you what chapter that is. The chapters move very fast. They are relatively short chapters, as is the way of the novel these days. There was a knock at the door, which was odd, and no one knocked on the door. They either texted from feet away or rang the bell. No one knocked. Detectives from the Chicago Police Department knocked. Now I'm going to skip down a little, and one of them says, we're investigating the Chris Hawkins case and would like to go over a few things with you. They're talking to the mate of Mr. Hawkins, just to verify some items we're working, wondering about. We understand you and Mr. Hawkins live here together. Yes. Could we come in? We only need a few minutes. Then here is the female protagonist of the book giving them what for, I think. She says, actually, Mr. Hawkins is here at the moment, on the first floor guest bedroom, recovering from the broken bones and various other injuries inflicted the night he was mistakenly identified and your guys beat the living crap out of him. That's a good beginning to a chapter, Lorraine Devon Wilkie. We're going to take a little short break and come back and give away as much of the plot of her fantastic book, The Alchemy of Noise, as we can. She's on the phone from California, and we, Lorraine and I, will be right back. Welcome back. The novel is titled The Alchemy of Noise. The author is Lorraine Devon Wilkie. The cover shot is of the city of Chicago on a gray, cloudy day, much like today. The story is about, a woman who works at a, and I would love it if this place were real. It's called The Church.
I know.
It's called The Church. This is like your dream small venue rock and roll joint, isn't it?
Totally. I want to be there.
Yeah, me too. She starts a relationship with this guy. You know, you have a real feel for the music scene in Chicago, but you also have a real feel, and I want to know how you got it for the cops and criminals scene here, too. It can't just be from reading reading newspapers from the city.
No, I wish that were true.
Yeah.
But being in a relationship with a man of color for 6 years, I was a party to many of those kinds of experiences. Which gave me obviously a firsthand witness eye view, and it, like I said earlier, it was a cold water dip. It was shocking. So yeah, I mean, most of those events that I put in the book, and again, this is fiction. But
yes, it's not about the two of you. Yeah, it is not about the two of you. Oh, I think we may have lost her on the phone from L.A. But Ben Anderson getting her back on the phone, I think. I think we lost her. So we'll have her for a few more minutes. So, again, the book is about, I will give you a short synopsis. It's about a relationship with a black sound guy and a woman who kind of runs a popular nightclub. It's set in present-day Chicago. They start dating. This causes familial problems between, of course, the two of them. Lorraine, you're on the phone again. I'm sorry. Sorry,
yeah,
we somehow
back.
Cut you off. I was giving a synopsis of your book while I lost you.
You didn't need me for that. So that was good.
No, yeah, we don't want to give away too much. But we were talking about how you and a previous relationship of yours that lasted a while gave you real insights into the. Into the way that certain racial tensions exist here between African Americans and police. Chris is arrested for a crime, and it sort of gets crazier after that. Do you think, Lorraine, that, and this is maybe an obvious answer to this question, that blacks and whites will read this book differently?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I at this point in the game, the majority of the people who have read it are white.
Yeah.
And their perspective has been shock and those kinds of responses. But there have been a few black people who've read it. And they, one went into great detail
sure.
and felt that it very accurately depicted the reality of life.
Yeah.
And the other one did not get into very great detail, but she thought she said it's very courageous, and I'm so glad you told this story. I think it's a very important story to tell, and I think it's a very important story for people to read.
That's a very good word, courageous. I do find there's something quite courageous about this book. Was it difficult to write? I mean, it's your third novel, and I have to assume that one gets more empowered with each published novel. Was this one more difficult than the previous two? There must be horrible storms or something. What do you think this is, Dan Long?
If I could get off the board for a second, I could go investigate.
Well,
because we don't have a producer in the booth either, so let me go run over there. Let me grab a couple spots here.
Okay, run a couple spots and we'll try to get her back. Because it's a fascinating book, The Alchemy of Noise. Lorraine, I don't know, it's like some conspiracy is going against...
Well, your producer said it was somebody in another studio. Because I said, I'm on a landline, for God's sake.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I'll have you back on, because I think... we've covered a lot of territory, and I think I hope I've done a estimable job of convincing people to buy The Alchemy of Noise. It's a real Chicago novel, too, but it also addresses issues that are, at the top of the news, but also at the top of the, changing emotional landscape of this very country. Am I making too much of that? Don't you think?
No, I think that's very much the case. And I want to emphasize the fact, because I remember my publicist was at a book reading, and she said to me at one point to the crowd, she said, by the way, I want to point out that this is a love story.
Oh, it
is. You need to make sure that people know that it is a very human, emotional love story that just happens to be told in the narrative, in the climate of a very racially provocative and dramatic situation, and how this couple tries to survive. I'm not going to tell you if they do or they don't.
No, I'm not either. But one of the things is, and one of the things, and I think your publicist is absolutely right, that you have to, as a couple, a white-black couple, you have to navigate all manner of seas. You have to navigate,
right.
And you detail familial seas.
Yes.
As well as the nature of crime and punishment in this country. I just think it's a fabulous book. How often do you get to Chicago?
I'm actually going to be there this weekend.
This next weekend?
I'm flying in on Thursday. I'm going there to see Jason Brett's play Miracle.
Miracle, the
Sunday.
Greatest play ever written about the Cubs,
yes,
World Series,
that's
victory.
Right.
And
that's
Jason,
right.
Well,
and
I hope to see you, but I also
too.
I'm going to finish your other novels, and I want to have you back on because I'm fascinated. I think you're a great writer. You have a great, great word for Hawkins. You call him at one point the unexpected man, and I just that phrase is so wonderfully weighted with stuff. Lorraine, Devin Wilkie, it is a pleasure to know you,
thank
and it will be a pleasure to read your other two books. I'm literally doing them in a kind of weird literary balancing act. I'm read a chapter and then read a chapter. But Alchemy of Noise is really, really quite something. And Jason and Lauren, thanks for the introduction. We have a lot of friends in common, Lorraine, if we ever got down to it. But Alchemy of Noise.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. You will be on again. You will be on again.
I hope so.
Thanks for indulging our technical snafus, too.
I understand.
You're a dear. Thank you.
Okay,
take care. You will.
You too.
It's a very good book, ladies and gentlemen. Coming up, we're talking birds. That's the voice of Tony Fitzpatrick talking. He is in here. He called me last week and said, hey, you hear about this bird thing at Montrose Harbor? I said, yeah, of course I've heard about the bird thing. And he said, Tony loves birds, and he paints birds, and he etches birds, and he does all sorts of things with birds.
Yes, he do.
Yes, he has for some time. Let me ask you, before we even introduce your two guests, Tony, Greg Neese, and Jeff Scretney.
Scretney.
Who used to work in Lincoln Park Zoo and is a friend of Katrina Wintkamp's, which makes him like a half-brother to me. How did this, if you saw the Chicago Tribune and the Chicago Sun-Times, there are editorials about these birds who have found a home at Montrose
Piping
Beach.
Plovers, they're...
When did this happen? When did it happen, and how did people find out? Was it a bird person, a bird watcher, who said, hey, look, there's some plovers here?
Well, it was Jeff, who was there when they originally started copulating, and he witnessed it at the very beginning.
How did you know they were there? I mean, did you just accidentally? Go ahead.
A few days before we saw them copulating for the first time, some people noticed them, and what's really cool about this story is there's a short backstory. These two birds, we could tell by the bands, they have colored bands on them, were the birds that were up in Waukegan Harbor last year, and they attempted to breed there. They were unsuccessful. Their first clutch was run over by a car. Their second clutch, the city's like, we can't have them here for 4th of July. They took the four eggs, they incubated them, one survived and was released. So now these two birds, looking for a new place where they were in Waukegan last year, didn't work out. They were seen at Montrose about a week ahead of time. They were seen together and apart, and boom, I'm there on one Tuesday, and they copulate right in front of us.
Yeah,
that's exciting. But there must be, when that happens, there is obviously a bird community.
Well, it's on eBird. It goes on eBird, and then all
what's
of a sudden,
that?
eBird is the bird nerd newsletter.
It's a citizen science project run by Cornell University, where people submit their sightings into the database, and millions of people all over the world submit their bird sightings
every morning. Man, it's right after the newspaper. Yeah,
but when this happened, the local bird community, immediately realizing the importance of it, came together and immediately had a plan. This, you know, if these birds do actually scrape a nest out, we got to get it cordoned off. IDNR has to be called. It's a federally endangered species. IDNR was right there, Johnny, on the spot, if I'm right, Jeff?
Yeah, they were there on Wednesday. On Tuesday night, we had to negotiate without really any help from anybody in the city or at Montrose a space, because there was an Ultimate Frisbee group that was out there, and they're like, well, we always play Ultimate Frisbee here. We're like, we can't tonight. We've got a federally endangered bird, and they're trying
and
to
how did
right
they
there.
How did they react? How did I have to believe, you know, I'm a city kid, and what I know about birds is from Tony Fitzpatrick and Kevin Bell, which is may limit my knowledge of birds, but it's not bad. I have to think that most people are quite understanding of this. We're going to talk about someone who's not very understanding of this. But
mostly
just,
they are.
If you say, look, you can't ride your bike here because of these birds.
Well, yes and no. And here's, so piping plover has evolved to nest up in the dry parts of the beach, which they're very pale colored. They look like little ghosts running around in the sand.
They're very small.
They're very small, yeah, smaller than a robin.
Wow.
And these birds have evolved to nest up on the dry parts of the beach that are the parts of the beach that people want to do things on the most.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everywhere these birds try to set up a home, they're stepped on, they're driven over, there's boats dragged over them, they're eaten by cats. Every place these birds try to nest, they're eaten, destroyed, whatever. And you gotta draw the line somewhere and say this. They gotta have a place where you're not driving trucks over.
So, how big, gentlemen, is the area that needs to be protected so that these birds? Well, you obviously saw them mate or whatever they do.
It's about 50 by 100 yards.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's what it is, just to give them nesting space. They won't stay just there. They have to feed.
They have
outside.
To eat. Yeah, right.
And so, they have to run the beach. They have to, you know, get food for the young. And the young are going to be there for 6 to 7 weeks. You know, I mean, they're going to be there for a while.
How endangered are these birds? Is there a level? Are there levels of endangerment?
There are 70 pairs in the entire Great Lakes breeding population.
Yeah. I mean, this is a code red
critically
endangered species. I mean, there are plenty of at-risk birds that come in and out of Montrose as well. We saw some today. Bank swallows, you know.
What was going on there today? It was a on and off crummy day there.
And volleyball.
They were playing volleyball, and you know what? The volleyball players were just absolutely great. They were curious about the bird. They gave the bird all kinds of respects, and there were lots of bird watchers out there, and lots of monitors, lots of guards, and
these guards and monitors are volunteers.
Correct. Absolutely.
They're all volunteers, and they're just sort of explaining to people why
Precisely.
They should not go
Precisely.
Into these specific areas.
A great guy named Joe Moog was out there today, and he was, you know, endlessly patient in explaining to people why they couldn't access that particular part of the beach.
Yeah.
And the problem is that people don't understand extinction. They understand it in the abstract. The Ice Age.
Or dinosaurs.
Cataclysmic ecological events. What they don't understand now is that extinction occurs by increment. It happens because somebody needed this habitat for a subdivision. Somebody diverted this waterway or polluted it. And habitat loss. Little by little, 1,000 paper cuts.
Yeah.
We lose species. And the acceleration of extinction in the last 50 years is mind-boggling.
Oh, I can
imagine. We ask ourselves, you know, 5-10 years later, how did this happen? This is how.
Greg Neese, I'd love to get your background about how you became involved in bird. I know you worked at Lincoln Park Zoo for a while, but I know about Tony and his affection for birds.
I started birding as a kid. I grew up in Lincoln Park across the street from the zoo, and I started birding as a kid in 1973. And I was
why? What motivated you?
That's a completely different story.
Hanging out on Wells Street.
I come from a showbiz, a broken showbiz family, and I was out birding to get away from my parents.
Oh wow,
That's another story.
Okay.
That's what I want to hear.
Well, we'll tell you. That's a good story.
Great story, by the way.
So But I was out, you know, I was out birding in the 1970s at Montrose Point and all up and down Lincoln Park. Later, I wound up working at the Chicago Academy of Sciences.
What a great building.
Dr. William Beecher was one of my mentors. Sure. And we were talking in the green room earlier. If people like Jim Landing and Dr. Beecher and Bill Jarvis, who the Jarvis Sanctuary is named after, if these people who started this effort in the 60s of putting natural habitat into the Chicago parks, recognizing how important this flyway is, if they could see piping plovers nesting on Montrose Beach today, they'd be in tears. Because it's the culmination of all this work, all this effort. You know, you look at, here's one thing, you look at Montrose Beach, look at the restoration done out there.
Yeah.
The only part of Montrose Beach that's not underwater is the part that's been planted with the natural dune grass.
Wow. Interesting.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
But, you know, getting back to the importance of the parks and the birds, this is a Chicago legacy. This is something that's been built over decades.
Sure.
Every park of every size, Columbus,
Garfield,
all of them have a little bird sanctuary, a fenced-off bird sanctuary.
Richie Daly made that happen.
He did. He did. Yeah. And, you know, and Daly had a migratory bird advisory panel that I was on.
Wow.
That met quarterly.
That's great.
To discuss how we can, what we can do to make,
help.
Make the city better for migratory birds. No city has that. And no city has the jewel of our lakefront and the parks.
True.
Yeah, you know, this is something for Chicago to be proud of.
This is where I saw my only sighting of a snowy owl. Was in Montrose. And I watched it kill a duck and eat it. And I got to tell you, I'm glad
one of the big thrills of Tony Fitzpatrick.
I'm glad I am not a small, furry, or feathered mammal or bird. But when snowy owl
comes to call.
Yeah, you betcha.
Jeff, what is your background?
I was a sales guy, and my career came to an end, and I needed something to fill up my space, and I ran into people like Karen Mansfield and Greg Neese and started looking at birds. And from birds, it went to realizing that if you're going to respect birds, you have to provide habitat for them.
Yeah, sure.
And that led me into doing work first as a volunteer at Montrose, where I sort of kind of got a sense of what restoration looks like. And now I'm one of the lead volunteers at Labaa Woods at Cicero and Foster doing the restoration project up there.
Wow, one of the biggest forest preserves in Chicago.
You guys are fighting the good fight.
Until these guys started, it was one of the most polluted forest preserves in Chicago. Yeah. And because of Jeff and all the other volunteers at Labaa Woods, which is something I raise money for every year, they've been able to restore about, 12% of it, 20% of it, something like that?
We're putting native shrubs in and taking out the invasive species, and we've got about 3,000 native shrubs in the ground. And today we were up there with a work group of about 20 people, and we caged 36 oak trees that we found.
Wow. I want to ask you before we take a break, and I'm going to continue on till 11 o'clock with you guys. Jeff, what is birds and beers?
That's a Jeff Scrutiny thing.
Jeff Scrutiny, what is birds and beers? Because it sounds very intriguing.
Well, you should it's go. I'll take you.
I don't drink beer, but I'll find something at the bar.
It's an Irish bar. You will find your what particular is that, poison. Jeff?
I was right, so intrigued.
So here's the long and the short of it. You know how fishermen like to tell stories?
Yes.
It doesn't matter if they caught the fish or not or how big or little it was.
Yeah, tell me about it.
It always turns into a good story.
Sure.
Birders go birding to tell stories as part of their thing. So I was with two other friends and said, let's go have beers and talk about birds. And they're like, we'll be there that night. And in January of 2013, we had our first birds and beers. And we have now met for 71 times since then, almost every month for 6 years.
I will go.
I'll bring you.
It's a roving party that hits different bars around the city.
Yeah. I've done that before, Greg. I might be not just an honorary member, I'll be the honorary vice president. We'll be back in a couple minutes and they get into the real controversy going on here that's burning up the newspapers and social media. We'll be right back. What is that? My new friend Jeff is showing me something.
Quote.
It's a quote.
What you got, Scrant?
It's the if there are people who want to help volunteer and watching these birds.
Absolutely, please give this information.
We the Chicago Ornithological Society is set up an email where they can people can let them know that they want to help out. It's piperwatch@chicagobirder.org. Piper, P-I-P-E-R, watch at chicagobirder.org. If you go to that, you'll find a link. You can sign up, and they'll get back to you and get you a shift so you can go out, watch these excellent birds, learn more about them, and help protect them.
That's great. Now, they're being protected now. They had a couple of eggs, right?
And those, yeah, they had four.
Four. And where did those, the seven?
Yeah.
Where did they go and who took them there?
Four of them went to Michigan to be incubated because they were worried about
it's
the
just
flood.
Really too dangerous to have them out in the wild. I mean, the rain and all.
Oh,
this.
No, they're sitting on three eggs right now.
At Montrose, the birds are sitting on three fresh eggs that they just laid this week.
They just laid. These are the egg-layingest, happiest plovers you've ever seen.
Wow.
And you know what? We watched a little plover chase away a killdeer from his...
Yeah, I saw your thing.
It was great. It was great. He was like chasing him.
Reason, ladies and gentlemen, that this issue is this David and Goliath kind of issue is appearing in editorial pages and long stories. A lovely long story by my friend Morgan Green and editorial pages in Sun-Times and Tribune is because Jam Productions is planning to put on a concert there later in August.
Yeah, Mambi on the Beach.
I don't understand any of this.
Now, this concert occurred.
It was elsewhere.
On the south side. Yeah, it was down in Bronzeville on the beach.
Yeah, okay.
And the way I understand it, the way Jerry explained it to me was that.
Jerry Michelson at Jam, okay.
They wanted to. Have, you know, a bigger space. And we went and looked at Montrose today. And with the flooding, it's not a bigger space.
Yeah.
And
this would be the first year they're having that at Montrose.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. And you know what? And you got plenty of time to move this thing. You know, so he said to me, well, we were on the phone. He called me, you know, about a week before this whole thing broke.
Yeah.
And I said, well, look, I'm not going to make a big stink about it if you promise me you're going to find another location. And I thought that was our understanding. And,
okay.
And then I saw him on WTW Monday night, and he dug in his heels about this location. And kept repeating that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Game Service says 1,000 meters is enough to keep these birds safe. It's not, you know. And we're not just worried
what about the noise.
We're not just worried about sound. I mean, the sound is catastrophic, you know. And he says there's a restaurant out there, Docs. Well, Docs plays music for a restaurant. You know, the decibel difference, and I've worked a few music shows.
Yeah,
I
sure.
I did the poster for Lollapalooza a few years
ago. I know, man,
ago.
I know.
There are stacks and stacks and stacks of amplifiers. And I love music festivals.
Let me ask
Just
you.
Just move it.
Let
move
me
it
ask
to Cricket Hill.
You.
Move it to
what,
Wells Park.
What would that level of noise, what would be the result? It's hard, you're saying,
well, it's you know... All right, let's put it.
It's not
give
worth,
you an example.
It's not
let's,
worth risking to find out, is what.
Well,
you're
let's
saying.
Give you an example.
It could be catastrophic, and we're not just worried about the noise. The noise is almost secondary to the human
people,
traffic.
Yeah, right.
People,
tens of thousands
have you ever
of people.
Seen a park after they've had a music festival.
Oh, yeah. No, good
Lollapalooza,
point.
Riot Fest, all of them. I mean, people leave all kinds of detritus around. And none of it's good
well,
for birds.
Let's call it what it is. The parks are destroyed for 2 or 3 weeks.
Right.
And
yeah,
it takes a Herculean effort and heavy machinery to turn it back to right.
And now Lala, to their credit, they pay for the cleanup.
Right.
Because they realize it's you know,
well,
it's
they make a mess down there. I don't know.
Oh, you bet they make a mess.
Yeah.
So Rick, you know, we want to look at these plovers. They laid four eggs, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says, in our restoration plan for this bird, we're going to take those first four eggs, and they did it because the beach flooded and it would have flooded that nest.
Gotcha.
That's why the first four eggs left.
Gotcha.
Now, the birds are still in the middle of mating, so they're like, okay, we're still ready to do this.
Yeah.
Laid three more eggs.
Three more eggs.
Fourth is probably on the way. And that's great, but now the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will let them raise those. It takes 30 days to incubate, 30 days to raise them. They usually fly after 4 or 5 weeks after they hatch. And that time frame puts us right in the middle of Mambi.
Yeah.
And those little puffballs that run around the beach and need habitat and place to eat, where are they going to go that night?
Gotcha. I understand.
And the thing is, this is an easy fix. This is jam. And, you know, I've always been led to believe jam with the good guys.
Yeah.
You know, that big monolithic outfits like Live Nation and FX were, you know, jam were the local guys.
Right.
You know? And when I saw him on WDTW, he just kind of rolled over Carl Giametti, the man who was the head of the Chicago Ornithological Society, and, you know, talked over him. And the guy's too much of a gentleman to respond in kind. But I just thought, why are you digging your heels in on this? This is the easiest decision that you're going to be able to make this year.
Now, you are.
And now, beyond this, the alderman for this ward.
Kappelman?
Is Kappelman, yeah.
Chicago Park District? Come on.
Yeah, I don't understand why he will not enforce the protections inherent in the word sanctuary, bird sanctuary. Why is he not protecting this? Why are they going to let this happen?
Are you three, there seems to be, to my mind, a sort of groundswell on the side of the Goliath, on the side of the Davids here.
We're just starting.
I know, not that I know, and I've known you for a long time. Yeah. And when you start, you don't let go. And I'm Greg and Jeff seem like minded in this. Are you guys and the other people involved? Are you confident you can win this thing?
I don't know, because this is Chicago.
Yeah, I know. That's why I'm asking.
The most popular music in Chicago is the sound of the cash register ringing.
Yep. What do you think?
It's going to be tough. I mean, but, you know, Mother Nature is also dealing a hand here, too. And like I said, that beach is underwater. And it may not be an option for them. Right now, it would take a major effort by the Army Corps of Engineers to make that beach. To put enough sand in there to have
there's
a festival.
Lake. There's a lake inside there.
Do you know
there.
If Jerry's seen what the situation is?
You know,
that's a good point.
I don't know
you are in an ongoing dialogue with him. I know that. And you're
we emailed each other today, and I think he's not happy. And I think he feels betrayed. But when I saw
by who?
By me. When I saw him dig his heels in, you know, when we ended our conversation on the phone.
You're not betraying anybody.
No. When we ended our conversation on the phone, I was of the belief that they were going to find an alternative place.
Yeah.
And then I saw him on WTTW, and he dug his heels in, and he keeps repeating like a mantra. This thing is, 1,000 meters, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife game mandates. And you know what?
Yeah, I get it.
It sounds like Trump speak to me.
Well,
really
that beach
does.
Isn't even 1,000 meters long.
Yeah.
But, you know,
not the way it is right now. And they lost 100 feet of it this year. You know?
Yeah. Rick, what it comes down to is we've got this. We should be so civic pride that we have piping plovers in a major metropolitan
city. This is a huge victory.
On our beach. We've done right here. Leslie, who's down on the restoration out there, the whole team, everybody who works out there, this is a win.
Yeah.
And now we're going to let some music producer take this away from us?
I have faith. I have faith, and I know this is Chicago, and I know all that, but knowing Tony, and now meeting you two, Greg and Jeff, I have real faith that
What I'm hoping is that Jam will rethink this.
Find another place.
And you know what? It gives me no joy. I mean, Jerry Michelson was one of my collectors.
Sure.
You know, and I liked him.
Well, there's no joy there.
No, I liked him for many years, but I really, really,
I know,
need for him to listen to his better sense.
And Jam is part of the Chicago story as well.
No,
I mean, it's a Chicago. They should be on the right side of this. This is something that the city should celebrate. And
these three guys are very, very persuasive, and I cannot wait, Jeff Scrutiny, to go to your
Birds and Beers.
You
could call it Birds and Beers and Bourbon, and I know you two will be there, too.
No, you're seeing the three of us,
yeah.
And what I need for Jam to realize
because there are
thousands of people standing behind us.
I know.
Yeah, there's a we have a petition that's got close to 4,000 signatures.
Oh, it's going to
happen. We've got
more.
The two major major.
It's 2 days old.
The two major papers have editorials supporting the birds.
Yeah,
read Neil Steinberg tomorrow morning.
Neil Steinberg, our mutual friend and a great, great columnist. Gentlemen, thank you so
and
much.
A bird lover,
Tony.
By the way.
Well, you never can tell about Neil. You can't tell about Neil. He loves a lot of things. And, yes, he is a bird lover. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Rick.
Thanks for having us, Rick.
Dan Long, thanks for producing. Ben Anderson back in the producing seat. Dan Long in the engineer seat. Thank you all for listening. Carl Amari's coming up.